The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We are in an 18 to 24 month window where there's likely to be real hell to pay in the financial markets. We're talking about the government finance bubble. And what is the simple conclusion, to reiterate last week's conclusion? Keep your powder dry. Is that a combination of gold? Is that a combination of cash? It is just the mandate that you better keep your options open and keep your powder dry.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, last week's interview was really interesting with Bill King. I love his knowledge of history, and it reminded me of something that you told me last night when we were sitting and talking, preparing for the show. You said, you know, Kev, usually when you invest, you need to have a good knowledge of history. But actually, those who understood history or those who understand history have really done the poorest in the markets here over the last 2 or 3 years. It's those who completely forget about history, that are just playing momentum trades or buying what they hear is popular. That seems to be the payoff right now, but that rarely ever has a long-term lasting good effect, correct?
Well, it's the issue of thinking and being engaged with the investment process such that you look for connections, relationships, and cyclical patterns. And all of those issues make history very, very relevant. Mm-hmm. In the last 4 or 5 years, you would have been blinded by history. And I guess the alternative is to say, well, then ignore it and see what happens next. And that's where, again, from a performance standpoint, from a, well, I wish things had been better in this market or that market over the last 2 years, 3 years, what have you. You can either choose to be blinded by history, or the alternative is to ignore history, but that is at your peril as well. And long term, I do think that persistence with particular thematics have significant payoffs and significant benefits. I would insist that history continues to be relevant. And even when patterns within the market are skewed by direct governmental intervention, it doesn't mean that history is any less relevant. It means that you need to look at the factors that are exogenous, these external factors, which are redefining the current course. This is exactly really what happened in the last few weeks here locally. You know, we have the Gold King mine just north of us in Silverton. Mm-hmm. And we've known that we've had a problem there for 100 years. This is an old mine. It's right. A very old mine. Right. And we know that there's toxic chemicals in it. And we know that they dribble out in very small amounts. But what we didn't know and didn't anticipate was the EPA's tinkering with and trying to manage this problem, which created an environmental disaster. The verdict is still out as to whether or not the EPA killed this river, as other rivers in the country have been killed by industry going back 50 to 100 years.
Well, you know, we talk about the EPA, and yes, it is a disaster right now, and it's horrible. It's one of those things no one around here jokes about because it's just too close to home. But, you know, you look at the intervention in the markets, Dave. We've been told by the Federal Reserve for years now that they're going to normalize rates. They told us when unemployment hit a certain level, they were going to normalize. We've got unemployment right now being reported at 5.3%. They haven't done a darn thing. So at this point, are they realizing that their management, they can't step away from this catastrophe that they've been managing?
I picture what happened up in Silverton, and it really is an apt picture of what's happening today in the financial markets. You're walling up natural pressure, and you're holding it back, and it doesn't take very much to breach that, and then the natural energy that you've held pent up becomes an uncontrollable force.
And that's what the EPA said. They said, you know, we had no idea. We knew it was a problem, but we lost control.
And what they were doing is digging on a berm, and a trickle became a flood. And by compromising the integrity of what was holding back this natural force, all of a sudden natural forces took over. And you do see that in the marketplace, where you can suspend reality for a certain amount of time. You can manipulate markets for a certain amount of time. You can have bear raids in certain asset classes here and there. And it's very effective for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then you realize that natural forces are more important than the interventionary forces.
Dave, there's always people who see these things coming ahead of time, and they sound like fools until it actually happens. There was a letter to the editor in the Silverton Standard 5 days before this catastrophe occurred up in Silverton that really ruined our river. And this man was a geologist for 47 years, and he warned the people. He said, what's about to happen could be catastrophic.
And do you know what is happening here? And he detailed why the EPA would perhaps precipitate an event, because they're looking for superfunding. And they haven't been able to convince the powers that be that they need $100-200 million to create a superfund site there in Silverton. And that what was actually in play was politics, not an environmental salvation, but actually, you know, creating an issue that then required a solution. And I think that's fascinating too, in terms of a parallel. What do we have today where you've got issues which are created and a solution that's prepackaged to solve it?
So let's talk about this, because unemployment's being reported at 5.3%. Now, that's well below what the Federal Reserve said they would start normalizing rates at, yet they haven't done so. And you've talked about this fall, we'll probably see a very small increase in rates. But again, they're still managing the situation.
Yeah. So for 2 weeks now, we've been sitting on this number. Yes, it's still 5.3%. And it's in the context of a participation rate that matches the recessionary period of the late 70s, 1977 to be precise. We're talking about those who are actually working in the labor force, able to work and are actually working. 62.6%.
So a little less than two-thirds of the people who are out there are actually working. That's the participation rate.
Yeah, and I know there's actually, it's been 2 weeks since this happened, but I think that the behavior in the marketplace was very telling. We had the non-farms payroll number. It came out, and it triggered a sell-off in the Dow, even though, you know, 215,000 versus the 225,000 number that was expected. It's a very minor disappointment. But think about this. It was not bad enough to be good for the stock market.
It's just so ironic, Dave. It takes bad news now for the stock market to go up, because bad news means that the Fed may delay.
And it means the interventionary forces that are there, the external forces, which are sort of creating a different kind of reality in the equities market and the bond market, gets to stay. It gets to linger. Mm-hmm. So again, minor disappointment, no longer enough to motivate the Fed to extend zero interest rate policy and keep rates low. So you've got September to December. That's the time frame for a rate rise. And as you look around the world, you've got a lot riding on this coming tightening cycle.
Well, look at the currency markets.
They're frayed. You've got the credit markets, which are beginning to, in earnest, fray. When we'll talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. Both of these areas, both the credit markets and the currency markets, you know, play this in reverse. They would be relieved by a delay or indefinite postponement. So you've got the prospects of refinancing, and this is where the rubber meets the road with corporations. The prospects of refinancing at higher rates in the years to come, who does that weigh on? Mm-hmm. It weighs on municipalities. It weighs on corporations. It weighs on the government themselves. So you've got a reason to keep rates low and sort of sit on them, if you will. On the other hand, they've made a verbal promise and they do want to carry forward the narrative of recovery. Therefore, the first evidence of recovery would be, yes, because it's recovering, we'll do exactly what we said we'd do and raise rates. But there's implications.
But Dave, like you've said here over the last several weeks, we probably will see a small rate increase, just to say they did, like a quarter of a percent, something inconsequential.
And as King mentioned last week, it's three steps and then a stumble. The first rate increase is not a big deal. By the time you get to the third rate increase, the market begins to recalibrate and say, okay, we are dealing with a trend change and not just an anomaly. The economy, quite frankly, can't handle the series of hikes. So just one more observation on the non-farm payrolls number. If we are nearing full employment, and that's the case that's made by these academics, we're nearing full employment, you would ordinarily expect to see a push higher in wages.
Right. Everybody's income's dropping, Dave.
Right. But in an environment where you have full employment, employers are forced to say, hey, how am we going to keep the talent and not have them migrate? How are we going to attract the best talent? We're going to have to pay more. income is way behind the curve for this part of the quote-unquote recovery cycle, if, in fact, the employment numbers are genuine. So, yes, I'm kind of back to suggesting that the employment picture is more complicated than that sort of simple 5.3% statistic. It is a fabrication. How do I know it's a fabrication? Keep this in mind as we close this out. 40% of the jobs created in the last month, that is, well, 37-38%, 83,000 out of the 215,000 came from the birth death model,
which is a made up.
It's not real. It's a statistically convenient addition. So not only did it disappoint minorly, 215 versus 225, but 83 out of the 215 were literally somebody saying, what are we going to pencil in this month? There's your recovery.
Bill King brought this out last week. He said, you know, the very rich have been benefiting from government intervention. They're getting the benefit of QE and their asset prices rising.
And if you're receiving entitlements, you're not doing poorly either because no entitlements have been cut.
So the very poor, same type of thing. But, you know, Cato Institute just had a poll and there are a record number of Americans, and probably most of these people represent the middle class that are being destroyed, that feels the government's too big.
Right. Americans think government's too big. That's 64%. Too powerful, 60%. And too wasteful. And I guess the question lingers, do any of these folks show up on election day? Because you have the makings of a political shift, a major political shift. And sometimes political shifts are very positive. Sometimes they're very negative. And it kind of depends on how the wind blows on the election day. A lot of things can happen between now and then.
Don't you think people are sick of pork barrel spending, though, at this point?
That's the question. I mean, you're sick of pork barrel spending if it's pork barrel spending on someone else, but is self-interest and the pork barrel benefits, do they become too compelling when it's time to put your favorite politician in office? I think you've got people with good instincts, but perhaps a weak will when it comes to voting. And what are they actually voting for? Are they voting for what's best for the country? Or are they voting for their pocketbooks?
Well, and obviously, you brought up 2 weeks ago healthcare and how the cost of healthcare is rising, the insurance side of it, rising for the company and for the employer. I mean, we're talking not just small rises, but healthcare actually is a couple of times what it cost before.
Right. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis looks at the growth in our economy and compares it to the growth in spending on healthcare. And the healthcare spending is growing at 2 times that of sort of the general economic growth. And I think it's interesting. I think it's very convenient that government has positioned themselves to be in the center of this sort of explosion of growth. Again, I think it's consistent with the Cato polls because you are talking about government getting involved in sort of the heart of economic activity. I don't think long-term that's very healthy.
You know, when we talked to Pippa Malmgren a couple of months ago, she said there's a phenomenon that occurs with a goalie. And I know goalie is your favorite position, Dave.
That's the position I played in hockey and in lacrosse and in soccer.
Okay, but see if this is true, because she said in her book and, you know, when we were doing the commentary, that a goalie feels he has to move one direction or the other to show that he's moving one direction or another.
And you're talking about a penalty shot in particular.
Yeah.
So you're standing there in the middle, you're waiting to take the penalty shot, and statistically, he would be better off if he stayed put.
Right.
But you can't just stand there and do nothing.
Right, because then if they get the goal, they'll be like, you idiot.
Right, so you take a 50-50 shot and either dive right or left if you're playing soccer, but you make a commitment knowing that it looks better to do something than do nothing, even though statistically you're better off doing nothing.
Well, then let me ask you, do you think that Buffett possibly did that here recently? You know, he's probably been sick of sitting on just a ton of cash. You know, he's not going to be able to get any kind of fixed income. So this latest deal with Precision Cast Parts, I mean, was that a goalie move to the left or a goalie move to the right just to do something?
I think he does have to do something. I think he's looking at a $66 billion cash position and realizing that, you know, he's getting nothing. He's getting nothing for it. In a zero interest rate environment, he's earning next to nothing, and it's time to do something. He must do something. He can't just sit there. And he also knows he's got regular cash flow coming in from his various businesses to replenish that over time and give him the ability to make another purchase in the future. But there is a different complexity to this purchase, say, compared to the Burlington Northern when he bought the railroad a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He is paying a premium for the company, whereas when he bought Burlington Northern, he was getting it at a very reasonable price.
Hmm.
And I guess, again, the subtext here is that anything is better than nothing. And when you exist in an interest-free world, this is a challenge not only for a middle-class household, a saver, someone living on a fixed income, but even for Warren Buffett.
Well, and we're getting so many mixed signals right now. You know, the stock market, even though it's been holding near all-time highs, it's been signaling within the last several weeks, several times, it's gotten very close to the signal that it's about to go into a bear market.
Well, you had a 7-day stretch where the price declined to within 24 points of what technicians would call a death cross. Mm. And that is where your 50-day moving average moves below your 200-day moving average. And then immediately following the 7-day decline, you've got a Monday rally. It was very important because if that cross occurs, and it could occur anytime,
right. Days,
weeks, but as and when it occurs, if it occurs, you're talking about fireworks. So this is a technical setup that could be a trigger for sort of underlying unease in the stock market. And you see those areas of underlying unease in other places. You know, you look at the falling of the media stocks not long ago.
You know, Dave, on Sunday nights, as you know, we like to grill steak, you know, open a bottle of wine and watch America's Funniest Home Videos, which happens to be owned by Disney. And then my wife watches Dancing with the Stars, which happens to be owned by Disney. And then we watch the news, which happens to be owned by Disney. It seems that this media conglomerate has taken on an entire economy. But look at what media has done here recently in the stock market. It's sort of scary.
Well, you know, from 2009 to the present, the media stocks have done very well. If you're looking at Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, these have been some of the darlings that have done exceptionally well. And a part of that, I think, ties to ease of credit. Mm-hmm. Cheaper money gets, the easier it is to justify in a budget advertising. Advertising dollars go out the door. And guess who benefits from advertising dollars? Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, and a few others.
Well, and let's don't forget about Apple, okay? Apple seems to be an entire world unto itself, but Apple's not been doing well here, this stock anyway.
Well, and I guess the point with those media stocks is that they've been in decline, a pretty severe decline, along with Apple for a little while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it's kind of running in a contrary trend to this all is well, the stock market's going higher. Read one analyst just this week who said, no, the next move higher for stocks, 50% higher without a doubt. And again, nobody knows anything about anything, really.
Right.
If you tell me you know what tomorrow holds, I have to discount your opinion because nobody really knows what the future holds. But the more certain you are about an outcome that occurs tomorrow.
Run away.
And I think you're seeing Apple signal something. I think you're seeing Samsung signal something, actually suffering as much or more than Apple, along with the media stocks. And it's these breaks, violent reactions to shares and inside shares, which are disappointing. Anywhere from 10 to 25% declines in short, swift breaks on disappointing news. What that says to me is that markets are feeling edgy. You've got participants who don't need much of a reason to sell and get out. And they are stuck with the mindset that you get at the end of a credit cycle. You want as much return as possible. And you'll do that in spite of the risks becoming more pronounced. At the beginning of a credit cycle, you're very concerned, you're very cautious. At the end of a credit cycle, you're just chasing yield.
Well, you know, there's one institution, Dave, that seems to be very accurate in predicting recessions. Now, they've gotten timid over the last few years because they predicted a recession 3 years ago, and it really didn't play out. They disappeared for a couple of years. What I'm talking about is the ECRI.
Economic Cycles Research Institute has been crucified by the media because they called for recession in 2011. They called for a recession in 2012, 13.
Then they went away, didn't they?
Well, I think they've spent a lot of time defending their cycle research, mm-hmm. and they're back suggesting that we're on the cusp of a 2015 recession. They haven't said definitively that we're there, but I think what's interesting is you've got the highest levels of direct market intervention in world history, and guys who are looking backwards at history to say, what do we know about what's coming next? Do we have any sense for trends in terms of hiring, trends in terms of economic growth rates, trends in terms of whether or not we're heading into or are already in the midst of a recession? Mm-hmm. And they had good evidence in 11, 12, and 13, consistent with the evidence which helped them call a number of recessions prior to that, that we were, in fact, heading into those recessions.
They've got good indicators. Just they seem to be irrelevant at one point here while the intervention was going on.
They certainly become less relevant in the context of quantitative easing, right, in terms of government spending programs, both here and abroad. And so it's interesting. Are these indicators flashing trouble? Were they flashing trouble in these same time frames as well? Or are their indicators garbage? Can we suggest that because they missed 11, 12, and 13, their calls on recession, that their cycle studies are irrelevant?
Well, it's like what we said in the beginning of the program. If you knew history, you did poorly over the last 3 or 4 years in investing because you were investing because of historic indicators.
This is the challenge of analysis in a command economy. Analysis sells at a discount in the context of a command economy. Why? Because analysis doesn't really matter. Price setting matters. Price controls matter. Even if those things are not enduring, even if they cannot exist in perpetuity, if they're very temporary in nature, this is a real challenge. The levels of direct market intervention through those time frames were astounding. I think they still are astounding in many parts of the world. And perhaps we just resign ourselves to a brave new world in which it's sort of always summer, never winter, and maybe ice cream is free for all.
So you've got 4 kids, Dave, and when they come to you and they say, Daddy, can I just have unlimited ice cream? In a way, let's switch this around because later they're going to start understanding the meaning of money. Daddy, can I have unlimited money? Isn't that what quantitative easing is? I mean, I look at what Jeremy Corbyn is recommending in England right now, and he's basically saying, yeah, QE, stop giving it to the banks. It's not getting spent. Go ahead and keep printing money. Let money grow on trees, but let's go ahead and give it to the people.
Right. Well, this is what we talked about last week with Bill King. To a certain degree, QE for the people has existed for a long time in the form of entitlements. Mm-hmm. What he's suggesting, what Jeremy Corbyn is suggesting, is that we ramp that up through various infrastructure projects and new ways of doling out cash directly to the people. The problem, he says, is not in the monetary transmission mechanism. He's saying that we're trying to go through banks, and it would be far more effective if you just got rid of the middleman. Mm-hmm. And it sounds preposterous, but in one sense, I like the idea. Listen to me. Carefully. Okay. I hit a nerve
away.
With you.
I'm
I hit a nerve.
Away.
I actually like the idea insofar as money printing is a cure-all. If money printing is a cure-all, why have a middleman like the banking system intermediating?
So what you're saying is if we're going to assume that money printing is a cure, which is what they're assuming right now,
then
go ahead and just
it
give it directly to the people.
And if you think that QE is the answer, then streamline it, simplify it, make sure that ice cream is free for all.
Right. Give the ice cream to the bankers.
That's right.
It melts.
Well, and again, this is maybe stepping off the edge here, but Michel Foucault was a philosophy professor who had an extraordinarily degenerate life, and he celebrated breaking all the rules. And he basically said, all the rules are conventions, man-made and should be destroyed. Anything that represents a meta-narrative to which I'm supposed to be subject to, I'm going to fight against, and I'm going to fight against it actively. So his last days as a dying man of AIDS was going to as many places as he could, infecting as many people with AIDS as possible. Now, here's what's interesting about him. He was consistent with his worldview. Okay.
Yeah. He wasn't a hypocrite. He was consistent with his worldview.
He was consistent with his worldview.
As horrible as that might have been.
As horrible as that might have been, he was consistent with his worldview.
Well, it reminds me of the movie Batman. Heath Ledger's version of Joker was eerie because he was so consistent with his philosophy. And there was a speech in that movie where he basically expounds his philosophy and you realize this is a twisted character who truly believes and is acting on what he believes. Hitler was the same way. And, you know, in fact, it reminds me of Jonathan Swift, Dave. Jonathan Swift, when he wrote A Modest Proposal, this was to England at the time that people were having kids, sending them to the coal mines when they were well underage so that the family could eat. Jonathan Swift just simply said, here's my modest proposal. Just have kids and eat them.
And I think this is the point, that when you see a policy which suggests absurdity, why not just move to the logical conclusions
right,
and embrace the absurdity? Because the point is, you see the absurdity of a policy when it's taken to its logical conclusions.
Sure.
And yet we are in this twilight zone where quantitative easing is acceptable and printing money is a cure-all. This is where Helicopter Ben Bernanke, would be proud. He was more than a decade early in his anticipation of the popularity of free money as a cure-all and as an economic stimulant. And again, if it seems absurd to hand out money to people on the streets, that's what quantitative easing is. It's just to a different audience.
Well, and they don't just use quantitative easing. I mean, let's face it, zero interest rate policy has been another form of this free money, easy money attitude.
Now, the irony is Jeremy Corbyn suggesting this in the face of inflation rates, which continue to decline in the UK. They're backing off their expected rate rise. You're getting very dovish attitudes abounding in the UK because they still have these massive disinflationary trends present. And again, echoing King's comments from last week, debt is the issue. We have far too much debt. It's not us here in the United States. It's in the UK. It's at the ECB. It's in Japan. It's in China. It's a universal issue, and there's not enough inflation. And so the concern is, what do we do about that? Growth rates are expected to pick up, but the inflation rates have dropped by 50%, 0.6 to 0.3. Inflation's absent, essentially. So rates are going to remain accommodative longer. That is, the Bank of England is going to continue the same sort of near zero interest rate policies that we have here in the United States. So here's a little handy solution. You've got deflation. Why not create an inflationary offset? Corbyn and the Labour Party is trying to provide the people's money as an offset to this sort of enduring deflationary trend. See how that balances out? I mean, it's like fighting one problem with something that creates a whole host of other problems once you've started down that path.
Very similar to this river situation that we're talking about with the EPA. They thought we had a problem. Now we have a real problem.
We really have a problem. You know, I sometimes wonder why people fight the way they do to avoid certain things, certain outcomes. Deflation is one of those things. You want to fight the unknown consequence of a deflationary collapse where capital is destroyed and you don't know who loses, and you're not in control of the process, and you're not sure what the political ramifications are, and so you fight that fear a different way. Have you ever had a fever?
I have.
Okay, so the typical response to a fever is you take this fever-reducing pill, rather than let your body work out its issues. And in point of fact, this is not old wives' tales. A hot bath is the quickest way to break a fever.
So you increase the fever long enough to just get it out of there.
And it gets rid of it. Or you can fight a fever for days. You can sit in a tub for half an hour, or you can fight the fever for days, and it seems like you're moving into the abyss as you let the inferno get stoked, but in point of fact, it solves itself.
Well, it's like what Jim Grant wrote about the depression that occurred back in 1921. They let it happen, and it was over pretty quick because they let it happen. You know, China, I look at China right now, Dave, they're not letting it happen. They're spending hundreds of billions of dollars to keep things from falling faster than they already are. I mean, all they're doing is slowing the fall at this point.
Right. You had a request for 3 trillion yuan, and now there's a request for 2 trillion won, which is, in dollar terms, another $322 billion to boost stock prices in China. Financial Times reported 24 separate policy measures since the start of July to save the stock market from further decline. So far, these hundreds of billions of dollars that have been deployed already have simply slowed the loss of between $3.4 and $4 trillion.
That's huge, Dave. $4 trillion. That's amazing.
And, you know, towards what end? Is this a cultural face-saving device? You know, we are trying to expand our influence and reach globally. Is it advertising stability as the IMF considers inclusion in the SDR basket? You know, they've already concluded that in 2015, that inclusion won't happen.
Well, and that's big news. I mean, a lot of people were gearing up for the IMF allowing the Chinese renminbi to be included into the SDR system this fall.
And it's not going to happen this fall. They've set the timetable for a variety of things needing to take place as sort of preconditions to open the conversation again September of 2016. So what happens between now and then? Why are they doing what they're doing? What are they protecting? Why are they keeping? And it comes back to that same issue. They're protecting from an out of control market collapse which you can get in the context of deflation. And what are they doing now? All that they can via financial engineering. That's their priority.
Well, and you know, back in the old days, China exports exceeded imports dramatically. But now we can look at the economy and we can say, okay, how are their exports doing? But how are their imports doing? And they seem to be showing a substantial slowdown both on exports and imports.
So to some degree, you need raw materials both to build out your economy and infrastructure, but also for the goods which you're going to produce and export. And so seeing the imports in July decline by 8.1% was a big deal. The exports falling by 8.3% is something of a catastrophe. And that's what we were getting at with Bill this last week. The exports triggered the government's decision to devalue the RMB by 2%.
Which was a record. That was the largest devaluation ever.
Biggest single day decline in at least decades. And, you know, as the first olive out of the jar, a 1.9% decline in the currency, it's not sufficient to jumpstart exports. But if more currency devaluations are around the corner, I think you can expect commodity producing countries. I think you can expect other countries that focus on finished goods for the purpose of export to devalue in lockstep. And you just need to think about that a little bit more. The acceleration trend in terms of currency wars, what does that mean for you? What does that mean for the resources that you have? How do you position yourself in liquid assets that are protected from devaluation? So the RMB declines. And guess what happens? A number of regional currencies decline as well.
Well, we're connected. I mean, when the butterfly flaps its wings in China, something else happens around the rest of the world. These currencies have already been in distress, Dave. You've been bringing this out for months.
It takes the idea of financial engineering into the realm of economic engineering, where you've got treasuries and central banks trying to do everything that they can to create a certain growth outcome and growth picture, a picture that people can look at and believe in. And so, yeah, currency wars are not a future reality. They are a continuation of the theme that we've seen in place for a couple of years now, but are intensifying. I think you need to remember the context of a currency war, or any other war for that matter. These are the players. You've got politicians who are seeking social and political stability. Mm-hmm. And if that social and political stability cannot be achieved via domestic policies, then decisions are made with international implications. So finance and capital flows end up being the new battleground. I mean, I've mentioned Juan Zarate's book, Treasury's War, in which he basically says, this is how we go to war today.
Well, and he was with the Treasury. So when people say, oh, this is just conspiracy thinking, no. This is actually a tool in the chest.
Yeah, he would basically say, you look at the positive outcome that we've had in Iran, that was an orchestrated outcome directly through the U.S. Treasury. And we suggested this maybe 4 or 5 months ago, that essentially our State Department has been unseated by our Treasury Department in terms of international relations.
Yeah, Bill King, he confirmed that last week. He said, we're not getting near a currency war. We're in the middle of a currency war. This Chinese move last week was a form of currency war.
And it's the currencies themselves, which are the everyday ammunition for your equivalent to a financial firefight. Mm-hmm. Chinese are shooting. There's a dozen other countries that are doing the same. And the reasons are obvious. If you don't protect your slice of the global GDP pie, not only will someone else take it, end up with it, but you, as a politician, may end up facing the music. And no politician wants that to happen.
Well, and there are benefits to cheaper currencies. I mean, obviously, through the years, we've talked about competitive currency devaluation, because one of the things that it does do is it makes what you export out of your country cheaper, and it makes you more competitive.
That is the key benefit of a cheaper currency. And I think the game of snooker, you can earn a point by scoring in the traditional manner, sinking a red ball and then a colored ball in the appropriate sequence. But you can also win points by disadvantaging your opponents and making it impossible for them to score a point themselves.
So you either play offense or defense.
Well, you stand to benefit from their mistakes and mishaps, as well as your aggressive, proactive shooting as well. So snooker is a game of strategy, mm-hmm. where even a defense is an offense, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
For sure.
So, I mean, how does one central bank upend the objectives of another central bank? Look at what we're doing here in the U.S. If the U.S. delays a rate hike, the dollar falls, forces up the value of most other currencies, undoing the quote-unquote progress made by that other central bank. devaluation is progress. I mean, think about that. We live in a world where devaluation equals progress, and yet you can't have too much devaluation too quickly, or that's considered to be a destabilizing hot money flow. There's this catch-22 of needing devaluation to promote economic growth. But on the other hand, if the devaluation is too quick and out of control, it is a destabilizing force, the kind of destabilizing force that led us to the Asian crisis in the late 90s.
One of the great indicators all through history has been interest rates in the credit markets. And the credit markets often tell us a story that's true before, say, a manipulated stock market does, or a manipulated oil market or gold market. What are the credit markets telling us at this point?
It's what the stock market is refusing to tell us, that change is coming and coming quickly, because credit is rapidly being reappraised. And that is specifically the risk associated with credit. Risk is being looked to in the debt markets in ways which have been absent for several years. Puerto Rico, I think, has captured the imagination of investors. And there's a number of corporate entities too that are beginning to adjust. In other words, their debt is selling off and interest rates are moving higher. The cost to finance their debt is moving higher as they begin to anticipate the Fed hikes. And that has already put the credit markets on edge.
Do you remember, Dave, about a year ago, we were talking about how junk bonds even are starting to pay at levels that U.S. treasuries were paying at just a few years ago? In other words, the junk bond rates had dropped down into the 5 or 6% range, even though the risk of holding that bond long term was extremely high because interest rates had gone so low. That seems to be reversing.
Don't ignore the context. You're talking about the magic 5%, which an investor used to be able to get in a cash deposit at their bank.
Mm-hmm.
And now, again, this has been some time. A year ago, the average yield on junk bond was 5.5%. Think about what has transformed in the marketplace.
Mm.
Bank deposits pay you zero. If you still want your magic 5%, or maybe now it's 6.5%, you've got to go to what? Junk bonds? We are beginning to see a rise. And yes, that means the other side of the equation is being affected. Prices of junk bonds are in decline. And yet I don't understand it. The appetite for junk is still very strong. We talked about this with Bill last week because he lives in Chicago. Chicago is a junk issuer. Why?
Yeah.
Well, Moody's downgraded them last May, and yet they have zero difficulty in oversubscribing $1 billion in new debt. And investors seem to believe that a bad situation cannot get worse. Chicago being a case in point. Already in dire straits. More debt, more interest payments as a burden. Why isn't that a huge factor for investors today, discouraging them from those kinds of purchases, when in fact, they do the opposite? They want to lock in higher yields.
Well, there's a question on a lot of people's minds. Actually, there's two. If you're retired, where in the world do I get income off of my money? So I'm thinking that a lot of those people who are going for junk bonds are just praying and hoping that there's not a default. But we haven't seen defaults, Dave. This is the thing that's so odd right now.
And I think this is one of the reasons why I say don't ignore the context. Just because you used to get 5% in a bank deposit, now you can get something close to it in a very credit quality compromised fixed income asset. Realize what you've just done. You've shifted from something that's relatively safe to something that's relatively obscure and usually considered dangerous.
But history would tell you there's default in the future. We've already talked about over the last 3 years, history's been put to the side.
Oh, that's right. So looking at modern history, default rates are going down and down and down. And this is the question. As a market participant, should that give you greater confidence or less confidence? Because the way the market reads a declining default rate is we should step with greater confidence into the fixed income market.
Right. Even if it's junk bonds.
Right. So 13.3% was the amount of junk debt that was defaulted on at its worst in 2009. Now it's about 2.3%, according to Moody's. And you just have to stop and reflect on that. At one end of the pendulum swing, 13% of the paper that's out there is going to go bye-bye. Now it's 2.3% and improving. And this is my point. Markets are like pendulums. They swing from one extreme to the other. The current attitude, if locked in the present, will fail to anticipate the future. Record low default rates are not followed by record low default rates,
right,
but rather a return to higher default rates. The swing in that direction, we think, will be a characteristic of 2016. We believe the extremes of debt default are likely to come in that 2017 to 2018 timeframe. And here's why. We have had 6 years of routine refinancing and re-leveraging in the corporate sector, where low-grade, low-quality borrowers have gotten better and better deals.
Mm-hmm.
Their interest component has come down and down and down with a shrinking of the interest rate policy because of the Fed's position on rates. And this, quite frankly, has kept a number of companies from going under, which would otherwise not even be going concerns today. So in essence, you've got the lowest rates in history, which have served to subsidize failing businesses. Where do you think we're at in 2017 and 2018? I think not only with higher rates and these companies in a world of hurt, so not only debt defaults, but a lot more corporate bankruptcies.
Dave, I've got a friend who needs income in the next few years. And so they sat down with their financial advisor, who happens to be very much leaning towards the insurance annuity side of things. One of the things that I found as we do these insurance ratings, you know, we've talked about doing bank ratings for clients. We've had many people call in for the free bank ratings. We also do ratings on insurance companies. And I've noticed over the last few years, the increase in junk bond holdings in these insurance companies' portfolios, because for them to promise you in an annuity a good income stream, say 6%, they have to go find that income stream somewhere.
And it means they've got to load their portfolio with very risky paper, which if you think about it, if everything goes well, they'll be fine and you'll get your guaranteed income.
But what if defaults skyrocket like you're talking about?
Well, you could be talking about the solvency of the insurance company, and then your guarantee goes from a guaranteed 6 to a guaranteed 0.
Right. So there is a cost to complacency on defaults.
I think the bottom line is that complacency comes at an incredibly high cost. I mean, listen, how does it feel to be complacent? It's hard to argue against the carefree nature of complacency.
Things will be just fine.
Yeah, because, I mean, it does feel good. Don't worry. Be happy. But the debt markets, alongside with select emerging market equities, are beginning to get a grip. They're beginning to come to terms with a rapidly slowing global economy, the reality of which is not even remotely priced into the developed markets, either developed market debt or developed market equities. Stock and bond markets are in the crosshairs. And I don't know if Q4 of this year, fourth quarter of 2015, is when the stuff hits the fan. But we are in an 18 to 24 month window where there's likely to be real hell to pay in the financial markets. This represents the final setup in the largest bubble mankind has ever witnessed. We're talking about the government finance bubble. And what is the simple conclusion this week, to reiterate last week's conclusion? Keep your powder dry. Is that a combination of gold? Is that a combination of cash? It is just the mandate that you better keep your options open and keep your powder dry.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.